Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we are discussing Book 6, Chapter 3, Part E. The questions that I asked you guys about this were these. What was the meaning of this short chapter? And are we talking political ideology now? Seems like we're starting to move around to that. Uncle Drosselmeyer said, I liked the part when Zosima says, that is the modern doctrine of the world, in that they see freedom, and what follows from this rite of multiplication of desires, in the rich isolation and spiritual suicide, in the poor envy and murder, for they have been given rights, but have not been shown the means of satisfying their wants. For how can a man shake off his habits? What can become of him if he is in such bondage to the habit of satisfying the innumerable desires he has created for himself? He is isolated, and what concern has he with the rest of humanity? They have succeeded in accumulating a greater mass of objects, but the joy in the world has grown less. That brings to mind Erich Fromm. In the having mode, there is no alive relationship between me and what I have. It and I have become things, and I have it, because I have the force to make it mine. But there is also a reverse relationship. It has me because my sense of identity, i.e. of sanity, rests upon my having it. To have or to be, from Erich Fromm. And Saint Augustine, why then do we delay to abandon worldly hopes and devote ourselves to seeking God and a life of happiness? But wait, such things are pleasing to us. They have no small sweetness of their own. A decision to abandon them is not easy, and it is a base thing to return to them again. Interesting. I'm reminded of old Fight Club. The homo consumens loves to satisfy his desires to possess as many things as possible, continues Uncle Drosselmeyer. But between man and thing, there is a nurturer-destroyer relationship, binding both in a decaying syndrome. This is not just a critique to our consumer society. Sadly, it seems to be more a preoccupation of all ages. I Am a Norwegian says, I agree that the Garnet translation can be a little confusing sometimes. I remember having to stare at the first sentence of the book for a good minute to figure out what Garnet was trying to say. Every time, with the beeping during the start of the podcast. I just chalked that up to me being stupid, though. I think I got used to it, though, because the last few weeks there has been nothing like that. Even with that, Avse is much easier to read. I think I am too stupid for the Garnet translation, because it's just not getting any easier. Zosima has a point, says Norwegian. People have rejected the spiritual world in favour of the worst kind of freedom. Even in the Bible, people don't clamour for rules. When Moses came down from the mountain, he was met with people dancing in revelry in front of a golden calf. They had been slaves for a long time under the Pharaoh. They had suffered in the desert, and now they were free, a freedom which were quick to exploit. And to make it worse, when they are finally able to give it into their desires, Moses comes with rules to bind them and limit their agency. We don't like rules and restrictions. We want agency and freedom, you know. Don't tell me what to do. I don't think that's particularly true. But the story reminds us of what happens when we don't have rules. Left to our own untutored devices and judgment, we quickly deteriorate. There we go. We become slaves to our own passions and inclinations, just as Dmitri and Fyodor and the people under the mountain. It's an excellent bit of framing, displaying at once why we do not want rules and how they restrict us and rob us of pleasure, but also why we need rules. Yeah, well, because we are civilized animals. That's all we really are. And civilization has a lot of benefits, but all civilization is a set of rules imposed on a bunch of animals. And as the story shows, says I Am Norwegian, this isn't something new exactly, but at the same time, as Dostoevsky and Nietzsche pointed out in the 19th century, the death of God and the rise of materialism and naturalism was a definite change in our trajectory. Our cultural norms and assumptions around meaning and the pursuit of it have changed significantly, and I don't think for the better. I think Zosima is right to say that we are triumphantly rejecting the highest pinnacle of man's existence in favour of the gratification of our senses. People always did this, but it was not seen as a victory, but rather a failure to live up to one's potential. Not that I believe the path is too close to close ourselves in hermitages and fast endlessly. The diagnosis seems more accurate than the cure here. Well, maybe we need those kinds of people among us to serve as a reminder. I think Nietzsche and Dostoy were saying when naturalism and Darwinism, I suppose, to an extent, and what was the other thing you said? Consumerism or something like that? No. Materialism, that's the one. As we swept the buttress of our civilization out from under our feet, pulled the rug out from under us, the death of God, as they phrased it, all our principles had been based on some kind of higher power. Then they came to realize that we were just animals evolved out of a cosmic stew, and realized that all our morals, all our civilization was constructed around an assumption that we were created by something divine, and then to pull that out from under it would crumble all those things. But really, I think all throughout the Middle Ages and the Dark Ages and all the rest of it, we were just stifled by the church, and progress halted for a good few hundred years. They were very anti-philosophy, with a capital P, right? Before it was called science, even. But anything scientific, approaching scientific, was either all part of what the church was trying to say, or the church shut them down. Galileo with his telescope and all the rest, you know. I don't know. I think we're 500 years... I think we could be where we are now, technologically speaking, 500 years ago, if the church hadn't have got in the way of progress in the way that it did. I think they stifled progress for hundreds of years. All for fear that if we didn't have these rules, we would just become complete animal maniacs, and we'd all give in to our own impulses, and there'd be no civilizing us as crazy animals. And maybe that's right, but also maybe those rules that civilized us, that we self-imposed but told ourselves that God was handing them down, because you can't self-impose your own rules, they must come from a higher power, otherwise people don't trust them, because they just go, oh well, humans came up with those rules, and I'm a human, and I'm stupid, so why would I trust them? They must come from something greater than you, otherwise you're not going to hand over power to them if it's not greater than you. And that's how they solved that. They put a big gold god in place and went, no, it is better than us. And that's how they solved it. But in solving that little problem of how not to be wild animals and kill each other and torture each other, they also stifled scientific progress by hundreds of years. And who's to say we wouldn't have solved that other problem of animalistic impulses in some other way? I'm sure we would have. We had to. We had to solve it. Otherwise, we would have eaten each other to death. And I think that the solution oozed out of our DNA. I think it was... follows the exact same rules as biological evolution. You know, cultural anthropology was just a progression of the code of DNA that dictates what lives and dies in our biology. I think the exact same set of rules, it's a progression of that biological rule set. So we came up with a solution, good on us, but I think we could have come up with a better one. Anyway, what was I talking about? I got completely sidetracked. Something. Did I finish that? I did finish I Am Norwegian's comment, yes. Laura Weistich responded to it saying, "I agree, he made a good argument about freedom, but the proposed solution didn't make much sense. His reasoning that living as a monk helped wider society was lacking." Tekrific said, "Yes, as to Anders' second prompt, which was, are we talking political ideology now? Here, Dostoe becomes nationalistic and anti-global, to speak in modern terms. Religion for Dostoe was Russian Orthodoxy, and he had nothing but derision for Catholics and Lutherans. He respected the Greek Orthodox Church and expressed a will to reconquer Constantinople, Istanbul, i.e. taking it back from the Muslims. He even hints at a holy war when the monks finally leave the monasteries to confront the sullied truth of the world. I'm not quite sure what to make of this, to be honest. Coming from Zosima, I'm sure it could be interpreted as being meant in a spiritual way only, but quite frankly, the subtext is grim and bellicose. Bellicose. I am Norwegian," said, "I took that as being more go out as sheep amongst the wolves, confront the world, rather than go fight a holy war. I couldn't imagine Zosima, and by extension Dostoe, advocating an actual war. I'm not sure how much Dostoe hates other denominations. His criticism against the Catholic Church seemed apt and aimed at how they organize religion away from God and into the real of the three temptations, while his attack on Lutheranism was less of an attack and more of a throwaway line. I can't even remember what the line was, only that I couldn't infer his opinion from it. Though I'll admit that my interpretations tend to be almost naive, let's say charitable. That sounds better." Yeah, I don't know the difference between Russian Orthodox, Catholic, Greek Orthodox, Lutheran. I don't know the difference. All of those have a Jesus Christ, don't they? I'm pretty sure, unless I'm mistaken. Do they? I might be wrong. They just act in different ways from that starting point. I don't know. I don't really care to know, because I don't know. They're all, in my opinion, just different versions of incorrect stories. Myths. They're nice myths. And they're great stories. And there's a lot of truth in those stories, but it's not factual truth. It's symbolic truth at best. Symbolism is very important from a cultural anthropological standpoint, socio-anthropological standpoint, but yeah, doesn't matter what flavor of wrong you are, if you're wrong. Can I say that? Sure, fuck it. Alright, let's read the next bit. This is part F. And it goes like this. Wait, EF. How long does F go for? F. Sorry, I'm just scrolling ahead here. I can see a part H, but I can't see a part... What comes between G? Oh, there's G. Okay. Oh, okay, this is quite short as well. It's about 3 pages, 3.5 pages. Alright, part F is called Of Masters and Servants, and of whether it is possible for them to be brothers in the spirit. Excuse me. Of course, I don't deny that there is sin in the peasants too, and the fire of corruption is spreading visibly, hourly, working from above downwards. The spirit of isolation is coming upon the people too. Moneylenders and devourers of the commune are rising up. Already the merchant grows more and more eager for rank and strives to show himself cultured, though he has not a trace of culture, and to this end meanly despises his old traditions, and is even ashamed of the faith of his fathers. He visits princesses, though he is only a peasant corrupted. The peasants are rotting in drunkenness and cannot shake off the habit, and what cruelty to their wives, to their children even, all from drunkenness. I've seen in the factories children of 9 years old, frail, rickety, bent and already depraved, the stuffy workshop, the din of machinery, work all day long, the vile language and the drink, the drink. Is that what a little child's heart needs? He needs sunshine, childish play, good examples all about him, and at least a a little love. There must be no more of this, monks, no more torturing of children. Rise up and preach that, make haste. But God will save Russia, for though the peasants are corrupted and cannot renounce their filthy sin, yet they know it is cursed by God, and that they do wrong is sinning. So, that our people still believe in righteousness, have faith in God, and weep tears of devotion, is different with the upper classes. They, following science, want to base justice on reason alone, but not with Christ, and as before, and they have already proclaimed that there is no crime, that there is no sin. And that's consistent, for if you have no God, what is the meaning of crime? What? I don't think God's got anything to do with crime. In Europe, the people are already rising up against the rich with violence, and the leaders of the people are everywhere leading them to bloodshed, and teaching them that their wrath is righteous, but their wrath is accursed, for it is cruel. But God will save Russia, as he has saved her many times. Salvation will come from the people, from their faith and their meekness. Fathers and teachers, watch over the people's faith, and this will not be a dream. I've been struck all my life in our great people by their dignity, their true and seemly dignity. I've seen it myself, I can testify to it. I've seen it and marvelled at it. I've seen it in spite of the degraded sins and poverty-stricken appearance of our peasantry. They are not servile, and even after 2 centuries of serfdom they are free in manner and bearing, yet without insolence, and not revengeful, and not envious. You are rich and noble, you are clever and talented, well, be so. God bless you. I respect you. But I know that I, too, am a man. By the very fact that I respect you without envy, I prove my dignity as a man. In truth, if they don't say this, for they don't know how to say this yet, that is how they act. I have seen it myself. I have known it myself. And, would you believe it, the poorer our Russian peasant is, the more noticeable is that serene goodness. For the rich among them are, for the most part, corrupted already, and much of that is due to our carelessness and indifference. But God will save his people, for Russia in great in her for Russia is great in her humility. I dream of seeing, and seem to see clearly already, our future. It will come to pass that even the most corrupt of our rich will end up by being ashamed of his riches before the poor, and the poor, seeing his humility, will understand and give way before him, will respond joyfully and kindly to his honourable shame. Believe me that it will end in that. Things are moving to that. Equality is to be found only in the spiritual dignity of man, and that will only be understood among us. If we were brothers, there would be fraternity, but before that they will never agree about the division of wealth. We preserve the image of Christ, and it will shine forth like a precious diamond to the whole world. So may it be, so may it be. Fathers and teachers, a touching incident befell me once. In my wanderings, I met in the town of K my old orderly, Afanasy. It was 8 years since I had parted from him. He chanced to see me in the marketplace, recognized me, ran up to me, and how delighted he was. He simply pounced on me. Master dear, is it you? Is it really you? I see. He took me home with him. He was no longer in the army, he was married and already had 2 little children. He and his wife earned their living as costermongers in the marketplace. His room was poor but bright and clean. He made me sit down, set the samovar, sent for his wife, as though my appearance were a festival for them. He brought me his children. Bless them, father. Is it for me to bless them? I am only a humble monk. I will pray for them, and for you, Afanasy Pavlovich. I have prayed every day since that day, for it all came from you, said I. And I explained that to him as well as I could. And what do you think? The man kept gazing at me and could not believe that I, his former master, an officer, was now before him in such a guise and position. It made him shed tears. Why are you weeping? Said I. Better rejoice over me, dear friend, whom I can never forget, for my path is glad and joyful. He did not say much, but kept sighing and shaking his head over me tenderly. What has become of your fortune? He asked. I gave it to the monastery, I answered. We live in common. After tea I began to say goodbye, and suddenly we brought out half a rouble. He brought out half a rouble as an offering to the monastery, and another half rouble I saw him thrusting hurriedly into my hand. That's for you in your wanderings. It may be of use to you, father. I took his half ruble, bowed to him and his wife, and went out rejoicing. And on my way I thought, here we are, both now, he at home and I on the road, sighing and shaking our heads, no doubt, and yet smiling joyfully in the gladness of our hearts, remembering how God brought about our meeting. I have never seen him again since then. I had been his master, and he my servant, but now, when we exchanged a loving kiss with softened hearts, there was a great human bond between us. I had thought a great deal about that. And now, what I think is this. Is it so inconceivable that the grand and simple-hearted unity might in due time become universal among the Russian people? I believe that it will come to pass, and that the time is at hand. And of servants, I will add this. In old days, when I was young, I was often angry with servants. The cook had served something too hot. The orderly had not brushed my clothes. But what taught me better then was a thought of my dear brother's, which I had heard from him in childhood. Am I worth it that another should serve me and be ordered about by me in his poverty and ignorance? And I wondered at the time that such simple and self-evident ideas should be so slow to occur to our minds. Is it impossible that there should be no servants in the world, but act so that your servant may be freer in spirit than if he were not a servant? And why cannot I be a servant to my servant, and even let him see it, and that without any pride on my part or any mistrust on his? Why should not my servant be like my own kindred, so that I may take him into my family and rejoice in doing so? Even now this can be done, but it will lead to the grand unity of men in the future. When a man will not seek servants for himself, or desire to turn his fellow creatures into servants as he does now, but on the contrary will long with his whole heart to be the servant of all, as the gospel teaches. And can it be a dream that in the end man will find his joy only in deeds of light and mercy, and not in cruel pleasures as now, in gluttony, fornication, ostentation, boasting, and envious rivalry of one with the other? I firmly believe that it is not, and that the time is at hand. People laugh and ask, when will that time come, and does it look like coming? I believe that with Christ's help we shall accomplish this great thing. And how many ideas there have been on earth in the history of man which were unthinkable 10 years before they appeared. Yet when their destined hour had come, they came forth and spread over the whole earth. So it will be with us, and our people will shine forth in the world, and all men will say, the stone which the builders rejected has become the cornerstone of the building. What irony. And we may ask the scornful themselves. If our hope is a dream, when will you build up your edifice and order things justly by your intellect alone without Christ? If they declare that it is they who are advancing towards unity, only the simple-hearted among them believe it, so that one may positively marvel at such simplicity. Of a truth, they have more fantastic dreams than we. They aim at justice, but denying Christ, they will end by flooding the earth with blood. For blood cries out for blood, and he that taketh up the sword shall perish by the sword. And if it were not for Christ's covenant, they would slaughter one another down to the last two men on earth, and those two last men would not be able to restrain each other in their pride, and one would slay the other and then himself, and that would come to pass, were it not for the promise of Christ, that for the sake of humble and meek the days shall be shortened. While I was still wearing an officer's uniform after my duel, I talked about servants in general society, and I remember everyone was amazed. What? They asked. Are we to make servants sit down on the sofa and offer them tea? And I answered them, why not, sometimes at least. Everyone laughed. Their question was frivolous, and my answer was not clear, but the thought in it was to some extent right. All right, there we go, another chapter down. Have your say about it over at reddit.com/r/the Hemingway list. That's the one. I look forward to seeing what you've got to say, and I'll see you tomorrow.